And all I'm doing is I'm weaving together coherence to a moment that clearly felt incoherent and chaotic. And now I know in her body what's happening is you're taking a moment that felt awful, and her body will remember somebody being there with her, saying it over and over, weaving together that story. So the next time she has a hugely distressing moment, or fast forward 20 years, her body has learned that next to distress sits the ability to have a compassionate story to understand yourself. Again, like I always feel like if my kids go to college one day with that and learn nothing in school before that, I swear they're going to be better, you know, they're ready for the college experience or whatever life brings them at any point than any calculus or English skills they learn.
If you would like to join the conversation and ask your own questions, go to www.patreon.com/MrChaz and get access to one-on-one coaching with me.
What's my name? What's my name? What's my name?
Welcome to Mr. Chaz's Leadership, Parenting, and Teaching podcast. I'm here with the amazing Dr. Becky Kennedy, and I just had to connect with her. We collaborated on Instagram, that kind of led me to, with a bunch of other Instagram influencers, and I was looking at her content, and I really just loved it, and I really connected and aligned with everything that I talk about. She had a lot of really great tips. I knew I had to have her on this podcast. And this is the place where I introduce you to people who can help you on your parenting or teaching or caregiving journey. And I really do think that Dr. Becky is one of those people who can help you. Her Instagram is Dr. Becky at Home. So at the end of this, definitely look her up. But I'm going to have her introduce herself. Tell us about yourself, Dr. Becky.
Hi, everyone. Yes, I'm Dr. Becky Kennedy, a clinical psychologist. And I guess I kind of specialize in, I guess, parenting, but I say I guess because I really think about it with like a 360 lens where parenting can feel good for a parent and feel good for a kid. It can kind of lead to better feelings and better behavior, right? So to me, when we look at a parent as a whole person, we can look at a family system as a whole system and a kid as a whole person. So parenting always feels a little limiting. I also want to say off the bat that I am a mom of three. So anything I talk about, please know that I only do it some percentage of the time. Like, don't think I'm doing the stuff that I recommend all the time with my own kids. Like, you'll hear from Dr. Becky here, but my kids definitely have Becky, who's just parent, like trying to get by through this pandemic. So the potential for shame around parenting is so high. So we can all just start off right away saying, my husband always says he wants to tag my personal Instagram in my Dr. Becky at Home Instagram, because he's like, you would really like this advice. Like, you would really benefit from it. So life is hard in my house too. So that's a little bit about who I am.
I really love that. I really love that. And actually, I think you have so much value to provide. So I'm going to kind of get started. Usually we have a conversation first, and which we will, but we're going to get started pretty soon on the Q&As. And we're actually going to talk about not only questions that parents in my community had, but also we're going to talk about the viral video. I refer to it as like the Christmas spit video of the bio. I don't know if everyone saw it. If you want to look at it after this, or maybe before we get to that part of the conversation, you can go to my Instagram TV part of my Instagram, and you will see not only the video, but you also see kind of my reaction on it. We're going to talk about it. We're going to talk about that. I'm going to do a Q&A, but I'm actually have a question or two to ask you before we get into that. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
So, you know, one of the things I know we talked about on the phone, one of the things that is really challenging with work, with, you know, being with children, working with children, being a parent, being a caregiver in general, it's not just knowing the strategies or what to do, which is definitely part of the formula. You have to know what to do instead of like, I just don't want to do that. A lot of us are like, I just don't want to be my parent. Like, that's it. Like, I don't want to be my parent. I don't want to be that. But we also, you know, need something to replace with that. But there's this other part that is a little bit that is a little bit more invasive in our caregiving, our parenting, and our teaching. And it is has a lot to do with the way that we were raised. And I want you just, without even asking a very specific question, I want you to just kind of tell me what your take is on that and how can we, you know, reparent ourselves? How can we grow ourselves so that we can grow our children? And how do we really take control where a lot of times it feels unconscious?
Hey, that's such a great way to start. So yeah, I'm talking about this. So here's some general thoughts on this, right? So there's two modes of kind of knowing, right? There's our brain and those, that's like our knowledge. And right, we love our brains. It's so logical up there. It's so linear. We're like, oh, we know things. That feels so good. I kind of know what I want to say. I read this strategy. I'm going to say that thing. And then you get to the moment and you're like, why didn't I say that thing? Why did I yell at my kid instead? And I love our brain and I love our thoughts, but in my mind, our feelings, they really get no respect. And they should, because we feel before we think in the order of operations, because we're animals. And our feelings dictate our behaviors if we don't know how to regulate them. And if we don't know how to regulate big feelings, frustration, right, whatever might come up for us, that's not a logical process, right? The way we learn to regulate feelings is actually through the experience of maybe having them regulated with us when we were younger, or kind of doing that like deeper work we need to do with ourselves to essentially be the adult to ourselves we never had to regulate that. And that really occurs in every part of our body but our brain. So for anyone listening, what I think is really, really powerful and empowering, not limiting to know, is the knowledge is important. Like you said, I have to like read and I have to like figure out what I want to replace old strategies with. But after that, I have to kind of do actually harder work because it's also less linear and it's way messier, right? Any of us who are doing this work, like that is messy, right? Yeah. And it's really asking yourself, like, what didn't I get? And what feelings for me come up that I have a hard time regulating? Because the truth is with our kids, it's easy to say, well, my kid, you know, my kid said, I hate you. What's a parent to do? Or my kid made me yell. My kid turned me into a witch. I mean, I'll defend this all day long. Nobody makes anybody feel anything. We all have a magnet to feel a certain way. And actually, I think we all believe kind of our kids are going to heal us, but all our kids do really is provoke us, because when we see in our kids them expressing feelings that we were not allowed to express in our house because we are shut down or scared, we respond to them in the same circuit that we learned. And it's not just that we respond to them like my dad responded to me, but actually one of the things kids have to do, let's say if you grow up in an environment where your feelings aren't really talked about or you got punished a lot when you actually really needed support, you actually have to develop a voice internally that starts to yell at yourself. It's really adaptive by the time you're 5 to say, I'm gonna go to my mom and I'm gonna say, I hate you. And if you don't develop a voice that yells at yourself, you're gonna go to your mom. And we all know like that is not gonna go well. So it's adaptive to develop a voice that says to you, who do you think you are? Right? Really yelling at yourself. And then guess what happens 30 years later? Your kid says to you, I hate you. And the voice in you that you developed actually to protect yourself, to adapt to your environment, gets activated and it happens to come out to your kid. That's really, this is always a shock when I feel like I used to talk about this to friends who didn't have kids and they're like, wow, I'm like, I don't know if I have kids. Really rough, you know? But what's kind of amazing is if you look at your kids and you ask yourself, to me, this is a key thing I do in my private practice with people I work with. I say, let's think about the part of your kid that most provokes you. The part that you're like, oh yeah, it's their rudeness, or they never take no for an answer. Or it's something about the fact that she's shy. Like we go to a birthday party and she's shy and I end up yelling at her. I know I shouldn't, but I do. Think about that part. And then kind of reflect it back and say, this might be showing me the parts of me that were most shut down in my childhood. I have the chills as I think about that framework. And then what's almost an amazingly powerful strategy is because those parts were shut down in us, we have the urge to shut them down in our kid. And the best thing we can do to grow, to kind of close that gap, is what if I use my child and even that part as inspiration? What if she's showing me the part of me that I need to grow? What if I need to be a little shyer, times? Or what if I need to not take no for an answer? Do I push back when the manager says I can't return something that I know I shouldn't? If I had a little of my daughter in me and I said, you know what? I really do want to return this. Or, you know, I do deserve a raise. I'm not taking that no for an answer. I want a second meeting. We get less provoked by our kids because that gap between us becomes much smaller.
Yeah. And, you know, we would just by doing that and just by thinking that way, it also connects us to our children too, and connects maybe some of the traits where we, that may still challenge us as caregivers. We understand it and empathize with it more and really see it as something that is valuable, and we appreciate that. And that does, and even just the appreciation helps kind of release some of the tension and frustration when we are seeing the behavior, right?
That's exactly right. Like my husband and I talk about that with our three kids, right? Like we each have something in one of them that sets us off and it's totally different. And when we're really honest, we're always like, if I say to my husband, like, yeah, that thing in our oldest one that annoys you, like whispering, like, you could be inspired a little. And he's like, yeah, well, the thing in our daughter that annoys you, like you could do more of that. And what's amazing is if you get into like these power struggles or these constant issues with your kid, let's say it is the kid who always talks back. What a reversal to just go to their room one time when it's calm and say, you know what, sweetie, you do something really important in this family. I know I always tell you sometimes I wish you would take no for an answer, and I know we get into a thing, but here's the other side of that. That quality is going to take you far in life. It's going to definitely make for some difficult early years in the family, but it's going to take you far in life. And actually, today at work, I was able to say something to my boss thinking about what you might do. And that was actually really helpful. And so look, we're still working on that in you, but I just want to let you know, it's also something I really respect. I mean, talk about, like you said, connecting, right? Like to me, the goal in parenting is, can we turn disconnection into connection? Can we repair? Can we look at something in a new framework? Probably all relationships, that's important, definitely with our kids. And what an amazing thing to think about the things that provoke me. Can I show appreciation directly to my kid for that quality? And my guess is the next time it comes up, you've kind of infused positivity and connection before a moment that often feels awful and chaotic and disconnected. And then you've actually kind of changed the circuit when it comes up. You've added all that warmth.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, that's really powerful. Let's go ahead and jump into, I think that's a good way to just jump into one of the Q&A questions that someone in the community asked. There's a little bit of backstory, but I'm going to read it. The year I was born, my father lost his mother, sister, and brother-in-law, all in separate incidents. My parents then took his niece and nephew in and raised them as their own. I was born shortly after. My grandpa died when I was 5, when I was 18. My dad passed away when I was 25. I'm 39 now. There is more loss on my maternal side for generations. My 3-year-old was born with a congenital heart defect and was undiagnosed for the first 18 years of life. When we received a call from the cardiologist telling us to get to the local hospital in an hour, we knew we'd have an adventure ahead of us. He has additional respiratory issues that we still monitor, but is generally healthy and thriving now. He keeps us on our toes. I tell him about his story through photo books from his hospital stay and appointments, and talk about his medical journey to normalize things. And I'm also working through ways intergenerational trauma has impacted me in my life. I've often dismissed how significant some life events were for me and how they impact my life. My question is, how do I help my son understand his own story and the significance of it without re-traumatizing him? And how can I help him through future traumatic experiences, especially if they're traumatic for me? Additionally, is there anything I can do to reduce further impact to him for my own traumas? I understand it's genetically passed on.
Right. And because you shared that with me before, such a powerful story. You said one thing just for the listeners where you said it was undiagnosed for the first 18 years, but I think you meant first 18 days. because it just changed.
Did I say year?
For everyone, if everyone was wondering, this kid is not 18. He's a toddler.
Yes, 18 days.
That'll be a long time. Right? So first of all, I mean, I have to just like my just reaction to hearing that story is just like, holy moly. Like that's a lot. And that's not my way. That's not a covert psychologist way of being like, that is bad. No, more the opposite. Like what a warrior. And to me, and I think Chaz, you have a lot of people in your community too. We have like all these cycle breakers, right? People who are, you know, intergenerational transmission of patterns is so powerful because it gets wired into our body. And, you know, when I think about parents I work in and not work with in an ongoing way, like more than any strategy, I always want to like start a group or a session saying like, you are taking on like this amazingly epic challenge. Like you're saying, I am the pivot point for the rest of the generations in my family. Like that's me. I'm going to take that on. Yep. Raise my hand. And like everything's going one way and we're going to pivot it. And it's totally possible to do that. It's just also you have to appreciate like that is hard work and it takes a brave soul to be dedicated to doing that. And I think whoever's in that role, like I'm kind of in a cycle breaker role. Everyone has to take a moment every day and put their feet on the ground and their hand on their heart and just like say, wow, like I'm doing something really amazing. When I hear that story and the amount of collective loss, in that family, and he's trying to think about, is it a he? Sorry, I didn't actually catch
it. It is a he.
She's trying to think about, like, how do I do things differently? How do I tell my kid his story? And I'm going to get to that because that's such a powerful question she even brought up. How do I use the impact? Just like before you get to the how, like, just notice the substance of that question that you're even willing to ask. And like, just being willing to ask that question, I promise, is probably going to be impactful in your child's life more than we give ourselves credit for. So that's number one. Number two, the word trauma was brought up a lot. And so I feel like I have a hard time answering it without talking about what I think trauma is. Cause I actually think I think about it somewhat different than some people in the literature. Or, I mean, and I'm not the only one who thinks about it this way, but you know, trauma to me, it's not the event. Right? It's how an event gets processed. And even more concretely, anything that's really traumatic is stuff that kids, especially when you think about kids, are really left alone with. So when events are overwhelming, kids feel overwhelmed. It's not the event that becomes traumatic. It's sitting in a room alone with an overwhelming feeling, kind of looking around, feeling like, why is there no adult like confirming this reality to me? Why is there no adult talking to me about where my grandma went or where my dad went? Like, what the heck? Like, am I in a twilight zone? Like, and now I'm going to freeze. My body's literally going to freeze because this is such an overwhelming feeling to be with alone as a kid that my animal defense response has to activate. I have to freeze. I have to submit. I have to fight or flight. Like, this is literally too much for me. Trauma isn't an event. It's the aloneness in an event. And what happens then is the feelings get locked in your body as something called unformulated experience, which literally means like free floating feelings. And what's amazing, what this woman brought up, is what's the antidote to aloneness? Well, it's connection. And what's the antidote to unformulated experience? It's having a story to understand. What's key there is not a story to make better. Nobody needs stories to make better. I always picture our feelings yelling to us like, you have us all wrong. Don't make us better. No. I don't know where you read that. Like, we just want to be understood. Then we'll kind of chill out a little bit, you know? And every time we try to make something better, we're really saying to a feeling, we're scared of you. Because we only avoid what we fear and our bodies know that. So if you have to get out of a feeling, you're really just telling your body and you're telling your kid, this is too much for me, which clearly then it's going to be too much for your kid. So when you think about this family and you think about this congenital heart issue, what was that like for him? What did his body learn in those first 18 days of his life? Like, what was his body remembering that isn't connected to his brain? And how will this kind of intergenerational loss be passed down? I would say concretely, slowly, right? We don't load that on a kin all at once. There's so much time. And I think in the effort sometimes to do things differently in a family system, we want to do them quickly. Like, we so know what we want to do differently that we want to like get it all in, you know, but that can be overwhelming. So trust, like I would do it slowly. This is going to be a series of stories. And when we turn big feelings into a story, we essentially turn unformulated experience into a coherent narrative. It's just our ability to say one day, yeah, I look back on my life and it doesn't have to all be good. This happened and oh, that, I definitely didn't get what I needed there. And yeah, I did. I had this heart issue and I came into a family where there was a ton of loss and I kind of remember, but more so my body remembers, oddly enough, a lot of experience of warmth and connection around subject matters that were pretty dark and scary. And when we surround dark, scary things with warmth and connection, that's kind of like resilience, right? So this is a family where I would tell this woman, you sound like you're doing an amazing job. Take a breath. Give yourself the compassion that everyone else hearing your story is sending your way. Take some of that in and go slowly and keep telling those stories little by little. And your child will let you know when they're kind of ready for more. They'll ask more questions. You know, they'll look at you for a little longer. And this will just be something you continue doing over time.
Yeah. Yeah. Story is very powerful. And, you know, I also recommend a lot of, because we talk about trauma, I feel like a lot on the podcast. And so, but it's really great because everyone who comes on here, some of the same things are said, which is great. It's yeah. great to hear the message from different people, but someone always adds, something different. And I love what you have to say about, you know, unformulated experiences, and just the stories just to help us, you know, process it. And social stories are something that can also be really helpful. I'm actually going to make a video on that soon. So if you are listening to this, you know, go ahead and check out my TikTok and you should, you know, you'll be able to see it. It'll be on Instagram too. I'm going to talk about social stories and how you can create a, you know, social story for your child. Have you ever, spontaneous question, have you ever created a social story for any of your kids? And or let me ask you this, actually, back up. Have your children, mom of three, been through any traumatic experiences that you feel okay with sharing? And how did you handle it? And did they get Dr. Becky, or did they get did they get Dr. Becky Kennedy, or just did they get Marty Becky?
You know, to me, I'm you know, it makes me think about, again, that word trauma. Like, there are these big T events and there's little T events, right? Like little T traumas are like, right? And you know, what's coming to mind is not at this point any like really big T events, but to me, things can have quote traumatic impact just because you're feeling something in such a hard way and nobody understands you. So yeah, it makes me think about something. I really do believe, even Becky the mom, one things I try to do a lot of is, I'm probably the thing that guides me more than anything with my own kids is, it's not that I don't want my kids to be happy. That's nice. But I would firmly say, like, I don't want my kids to be happy. I want my kids to be really good at struggling with things. Like, that's my goal for them. Happiness by itself, right? And the goal of happiness makes you not tolerate the stress. And we all know by the time you're adults, you're like, that is not adaptive, right? Because the life stinks sometimes for everyone. So I think stories, and I always, like, you know, are really something I try to do a lot of in my family without any resolution, right? So actually, I remember one of my friends is over one day visiting and she watched me do this with my daughter. And I remember at the end, she's like, but now what are you going to say? And I was like, no, that's it, you know? And my son had a play date. And my daughter, of course, always wanted to be included, my middle. And I remember my son was actually like, yeah, you can play with us. And then at some point he was like, mom, I just like really want to be alone with my friend, right? So it's like a small event. My daughter totally lost it. Of course, right? Stinks. And you want to be like the older brother. You want to be cool. I totally understand my son's desire to play alone. So I kind of held that boundary. And she lost it, like lost it, right? And she's kind of what I consider a deeply feeling kid. She's big, big feelings, goes from 0 to 60. And when we were kind of like a little calmer in her room, this is all I did. I said, wait, I just want to figure this out. I want to figure this out. So Alex was in his room with you and his friend James, okay? And you were so much fun. It was so much fun. It was so much fun. And then, then he wanted to be alone with James. Is that right? Because they wanted to play Pokemon cards, which I'll get wrong, just so she can say it wasn't Pokemon cards. They wanted to play chess. Right. And then I'll say, oh, I'm so glad you corrected me. Now I can start again. So you were playing with Alex and James, and you can hear like my voice is almost purposefully like not hypnotic, but just there's like a regulatory capacity that I'm engaging in just by, okay. And then you dropped to the floor and you tried to get into the room and I carried you and you had, oh, and that was so bad. And you said you hated me because it just felt so bad and all to come out. And then I was in your room and then you yelled, get out. And I didn't. And this is not what I'm doing in the heat of the moment, but after it's cooled down a little bit and I'll get a couple things wrong. And then at the end, I'll just say, did I get that all right? And maybe should, knowing her, she wouldn't give me any satisfaction. She'd be like, whatever, you know? and I'd be like, well, it's just so important. I want to say it again. And then I'll say it again, maybe 5 times. And all I'm doing is I'm weaving together coherence to a moment that clearly felt incoherent and chaotic. And now I know in her body what's happening is you're taking a moment that felt awful and her body will remember somebody being there with her, saying it over and over, weaving together that story. So the next time she has a hugely distressing moment or fast forward 20 years, her body has learned that next to distress sits the ability to have a compassionate story to understand yourself. Again, like I always feel like if my kids go to college one day with that and learn nothing in school before that, I swear they're going to be better, you know, they're ready for the college experience or whatever life brings them at any point than any calculus or English skills they learn. Like that's just so critical to regulation. So to me, those are the things that I do try to do all the time. And then when people say like, but then did you tell her, but you can have a play date tomorrow? Or no, like I'm not going to undo all that hard work I did with like a quick fix. You know what we don't need more of? Yeah. Quick fixes. Like, oh my goodness, right? No, you know, it's just, that's it. That's it. And that's a really new idea for parents. We're like, that's enough. And it's, I think, wait, it's like, oh, it's so much more than enough. If my husband sat down on the couch with me when I was upset and just told me the story of my feelings over and over without a solution, I would just be like, oh, this is like the best. Yeah. What can I make you for dinner, honey? Like anything you want, you know, it feels so good.
Yeah. Man, I heard a lot of things in there. So like, even just by having that, by telling the story, and you know, you're bringing what was an emotional kind of like primal fight or flight part of her brain experience. You mentioned chaotic. You're kind of tapping into like the higher parts of her brain, her prefrontal cortex, the logic, and connecting it to the emotional experience so that she's, you know, as she's in the future, when she has emotional experiences, you're literally, you know, wiring her brain to be able to handle that in the future. And maybe, you know, just one time of doing that, that doesn't mean, you know, next month when, you know, brother has friends over and they're playing, you know, with the Digimon cards or whatever, that she's going to handle it perfectly. But it just like over time. And, you know, I've done that too. And, you know, I end up doing that like over and over and over and over and over and over again throughout the course of a day, because I'm working with, you know, a variety of children, and it's, you know, it's maybe 20 children in a room. So there's a lot of different dynamics. So there's a lot of blow up of emotions and just things that could happen. And it's amazing how you see, you know, when you tell the story, how when you observe and look, how they take that story on and it becomes a part of their brain and who they are and how they, you know, navigate and negotiate, understand the world. And that is so beautiful. For like, that is like my favorite moment when, you know, we're doing one of those things where, you know, we're talking about the emotions or identifying emotions or just telling the story. And then later, completely unprompted in a different situation, they're now using what we talked about, that story, in a situation that could potentially be an emotional meltdown.
And two things that I want to add on, I think, right, it goes back to what we started with, which is that our feelings are way more powerful than our logic. And it sounds like what you do with these kids is you give them a skill, but I could cry thinking about this. You give them an experience. We have to experience things in our body to make changes. We don't learn regulation I think I'm literally tearing as I think about this. We don't learn that in a class. We don't learn that in a textbook. We have to experience with someone. It doesn't actually have to be a parent, but we have to experience it with someone, right? We have to feel it to do it. And it goes back to reparenting. We have to feel compassionate toward ourselves to give compassion. Right. And then the second thing I just want to add on, because I think it's so important, and I don't say it enough, is I hate the word good parenting, but I'm just going to use it because like it could mean anything. But our good parenting is just not immediately rewarded with good behavior. Right. Like I don't want people to think in my house I do something and my kids are like, Mom, that was an amazing intervention. You're great. Like never. Right. Like usually like I say these things to my kids and they're like, can I have those pretzels now? Right. Or my daughter would be like, you're so annoying. Right. Like, and it takes an inconveniently long time to make change. And it depends on your kid and their temperament, but I'm talking about months or years. Like, I remember things that have sparked up in my kids. And I literally, my husband and I will look at each other and we'll be like, that was 4 years in the making, that one moment, 4 years. But if we weren't doing it consistently for 4 years, that doesn't just happen when a kid is five or when a kid is seven, right? Like, so just, it's really this long game of like, stay the course. So for parents listening, when your kid still does the same thing, have faith. Trust that you're still building that experience in them and it will click together just later than we want.
And that brings us to us, the adults, right? Who may not have had that experience. And now, you know, we have the challenge of trying to create that experience, trying to give that experience, being that experience with children so that they're able to, you know, regulate their emotions and handle, you know, tough situations and challenges, you know, logically, or just at least able to navigate through it and navigate through their own emotions. And that is such a challenging thing to do. So I actually, and a great example of this, great segue into the quote unquote Christmas spit video. I'm going to give a kind of brief description of what happened in the video. And then Dr. Becky's going to talk about it. Remember, you can go on my IGTV to see it. And you can see my kind of breakdown of it. So the video starts off with, it is Christmas, set the scene. And I want to say, this is probably like, I want to say after like looking at the girl's page, I want to say that this probably happened maybe like early 2000, maybe like 2001 or something like that. Preschooler girl looks to be four. Little brother's a toddler, looks to be two or probably a little bit younger than two because he's really wobbly. He can walk, but he's really wobbly. So two and younger, we'll call him a toddler. And the dad has a vacuum and he's trying to put it together, do the batteries. And the mom is sitting on the side and she's looking at the box and they're both trying to figure it out together while, you know, the kids are kind of doing their kid thing. The video starts off and it looks like the preschooler girl, 4-year-old girl, bumps her little toddler brother and he falls. And there's some word about pushing, but it's kind of just like, don't push, don't push. I think she says, I'm not pushing or something like that, but it's really hard to see. But she bumps her little brother. He gets up, toddler gets up, kind of moves past her. And then after he gets stabilized, tries to push her older sister back with his hand. And it's not a bump. When I say a bump, it was literally just like a bump. I think she was just trying to position herself to look at the vacuum, the new toy that she just gotten on Christmas, super excited, right? So she bumps a little bit. So he gets up, positions himself, kind of gets stabilized and tries to push older sister, but he's a toddler. So it's pretty gentle and it's pretty slow. And the preschooler sees this and is kind of has a reaction. Just like, how dare you? And pushes a good push. This is a good push. Pushes the toddler brother and he falls down. And then mom sees that and reacts and reaches her arm without getting up or moving or anything. Reaches her arm, probably a full length of her arm, grabs her child's arm and pulls her in pretty quick. I would define it as kind of snatched her up. Brings her in close, and the preschooler has a harmonica. And so so she's kind of blowing her harmonica while the mom's trying to talk to her. And then the mom pulls it down, kind of, I would characterize it as aggressively. I think the snatch was aggressive. And I think that the way that she pulled down the harmonica was aggressive and looks her, she's right at eye level. And she says, you know, I think she says, you know, don't push your brother that way. Don't push your brother like that. Very serious tone, right in the eye, kind of like almost with some intimidation. It looked like she meant to intimidate her. And then the 4-year-old responds by spitting on the mother. Then the mother, it looked like The mother was about to raise her other hand, but she didn't. But the four-year-old definitely flinched. And then the mother grabs the child. Well, she already had the child by the hand, but kind of stands up and then walks out of the picture. And you don't really see, you know, what happens after that. And we can't really speculate what happened. I mean, we could speculate all day about what happened after that. But she pulls her away while the daughter is saying, "No, Papa, help." And the dad is kind of there just, the whole situation, by the way, during this whole time, the dad is just stone-faced, really focused on the vacuum, not even really picking his head up to acknowledge the situation. And that's what happened. Now, in the comment section, and I think this is kind of I don't know if it's important, but I'm going to go ahead and say it. But in the comment section of the original video, there were a lot of people who were, I'd say a majority of the comment section, and this was on TikTok, was in support of the mother. Like, you did the right thing. Like, you know, kids need to learn, you know, snatch her up. That's right, mom, kind of thing. There's no other way that you know, should have handled that. That's the way you do it. Go ahead and do what you got to do. When you go on IGTV, you can see what my kind of analysis of the situation was. It's all connected. It's the video, my analysis of the situation, and then by popular demand, because people ask, like, well, what should she have done instead? I also have a video of that, too. It's all spliced together. Now, I want to know what your thoughts were on the video. I asked Dr. Becky Kennedy to watch the video before, and I want to know what her thoughts are.
Okay, so there's so many different things we can say. And of course, you know, we're not there. And, you know, it would be amazing to have this parent with us to kind of just unpack, right, what was going on, right? Because a couple things. I'm trying to think. There's so many things hanging in my brain. I'm having trouble picking the loudest one. Okay, so first of all, I guess I'll say, I think a lot about this concept, what I call like the most generous interpretation. What is the most generous interpretation of behavior? If anyone's listening, it's kind of a powerful thing to be like, what is this thing that my kid's doing right now that drives me crazy, or that I kind of consider a quote bad behavior? He hits his sister, let's take that, right? Okay, let's say my daughter hits her sister, her brother, right? Like in the video. What's my most generous interpretation of that? Literally, like if I had to force my brain, why would someone do that? Oh, because she doesn't know how to control. Well, that's not very generous. Okay, let me try again. Like, what's my most generous? And that to me is something I do when I'm in a tough stage with my kid. Like at the end of the night, when me and my husband maybe like powwow of like, all right, that was like a rough time. Like, what's going on? Yeah. I'll be like, okay, most generous. And we're going to start out the day tomorrow as if that's true. And here's like the most powerful thing. The most generous interpretation of any human's behavior at any age, I would say, is 99.999% the most true one. Because I have a firm belief that people are good inside. That like, and to me, the second point I make about the video, and as a parent in general, I always think that kids feel, whether we're looking at them as a good kid having a hard time or a bad kid doing bad things. And kids are wired to take in our reflection of who they are, right? We're our kids' mirrors. And we reflect to our kids who they are with our words, but with our glares, with how aggressively we snatch them, with what we do when we intervene. And based on that, our kids really start to form an identity. And when kids feel bad inside, going back to like attachment and evolution, they feel unlovable, right? If my parent, the person I literally need to survive, in a way I won't when I'm older, but I literally need this person to get food, shelter, and water. So I better figure out how to make this relationship work. If this person is looking at me like I'm a bad kid, they're kind of saying I'm unattachable. That is literally the biggest terror of a child. That is so dysregulating that kids have to engage in various animal defense, totally involuntary behavior. So if you think about the spit, this kid was already feeling so dysregulated. That was not a decision she made. That's not, we're fed this narrative of like, this is disrespectful versus this is dysregulation. Like, this doesn't have to do with my kid's feelings about me. This has to do with the fact that my child is out of control. Now, to rewind, something I think about a lot, and Chaz, I'm curious how you see this in the classroom. Once our kid is a little bit out of control, meaning this happened way before in the video, right? This is way before. We have to move from don't do something or please stop to I won't let you. I actually believe that the worst situations we get in with our kids when things get totally out of control come from giving our kids a responsibility that is ours. And it actually gets so dysregulated because our kids feel terrified that they're being asked to stop something. And essentially they're being put in charge. When they're looking at you, they're like, aren't I four? Like, shouldn't you be stopping me from hitting my brother? You already noticed I pushed him once. Aren't you the one, like, if I tried to run into the street, would you let me go and say, don't run in again? Or would you say, I won't let you run. I'm holding you. You can scream. You can protest. You can say, put me down. I will keep you safe. Even when you're mad at me, I love you that much. And once our kid gets out of control, I say that to parents all the time, it's powerful to note whether we do a lot of please don't hit, please stop pressing the elevator button versus I'm putting my body between my kid and the elevator button, maybe not even saying anything, that's enough. Or I'm saying, I'm not gonna let you do that, sweetie, because I think my kid's a good kid having a hard time. I don't think he's gonna do it again because he's pressing, quote, my buttons, or I'm thinking he's gonna do it again because he's dysregulated and it's a scream for help. Now, this sounds all very pro-child, but I'm very pro-parent too. To me, like, you know, we're all just like unhealed children and adult bodies, right? Yeah. We're all the same as
pro-people.
Yeah, we're all people. So this parent, one of the things I think that's a powerful thing to imagine as a visual is as parents, what we really react to is we see something in our kid that makes us really uncomfortable. And then we want to harshly shut down the behavior in our kid, truly just to harshly stop and quickly stop that feeling in our own bodies. Our kid is kind of a pawn in our own regulation game. And my guess is for this mom, she probably, I'm guessing, has not really learned a compassionate way of regulating her own distress. I would probably put that out there. And my guess is when she sees this, she has those like bad mommy, guilty mommy thoughts, my kid is hitting, what did I do wrong? And then we actually act aggressively as a parent, whether we're yelling or we snatch a kid, because it's such an intolerable thought to us. It's such a huge part of our identity. We feel like such a failure that we want to stop the behavior right away just to try to, quote, feel better. So to me, that's all going on and a million more things that we could talk about for hours. But there's just a lot there. Yeah, there's a lot of complicated stuff going on in that video, I would say.
If you want to hear the rest of the conversation, join my community at www.patreon.com/MrChaz and also get access to one-on-one coaching. And if you want to see the video that I referred to in this podcast, go to my Instagram, Mr. Chaz, and go to my IGTV and check it out.
What's my name? What's my name? What's